Trump attacks Cummings and Baltimore, Gabbard attacks Harris, and everyone attacks Biden. It's enough to give you a heart attack on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Joe Biden walked into Wednesday's debate with a big target on his back. Did he dish out as much as he took?
Everybody's expecting that whoever the Democratic nominee is going to come under attack from Donald Trump. And so they kind of have to show that they can take a punch and they can counterpunch.
Plus, in Mississippi, voters head to the polls to pick the nominees to become their next governor.
The political landscape has certainly changed here quite dramatically over the last couple decades, and the Republican is certainly the favorite.
And we'll listen to my 2017 interview with a beloved civic leader and political maven who died last week.
I didn't become his press secretary until about 6 months after he had come to the Senate. And it was one of the best decisions that I've made in my life.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And like to you, and think to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge. Because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 288 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The president, whom Democrats have been attacking for two nights in Detroit, hasn't done anything of late to get the candidates to change their minds. Donald Trump went from a nonstop assault on the squad, specifically Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, to an endless series of carpet bombing tweets aimed at another House member of color, Elijah Cummings, and the city he represents, Baltimore. Trump, for his actions, has been widely described as a racist by many Democrats, including most of the presidential candidates. Republicans, for the most part, have remained silent. But other than expressing outrage, Democrats have not come up with a plan on how to respond to Trump's inflammatory tweets and outbursts. And some in the party now regret having forced former special counsel Robert Mueller into testifying before two House committees last week, given Mueller's halting and spotty performance. He had said all along that he preferred not to testify, but Democrats issued a subpoena to force the issue. Perhaps they were hoping against hope that Mueller would say something dramatic enough to move the entire country to demand impeachment. That never happened. At the same time, Republicans, like Texas's John Ratcliffe of the Judiciary Committee, had no compunction against defending the president.
Americans need to know this as they listen to the Democrats and socialists on the other side of the aisle, as they do dramatic readings from this report, that volume two of this report was not authorized under the law to be written. It was written to a legal standard that does not exist at the Justice Department. And it was written in violation of every DOJ principle about extra prosecutorial commentary. I agree with the chairman this morning when he said Donald Trump is not above the law. He's not. But he damn sure shouldn't be below the law, which is where volume two of this report puts him.
Ratcliffe's speech, and let's be honest, it was a speech, not a question, may be one reason why just days later he was the surprise choice to replace Dan Coats as the next director of national intelligence. Trump has never accepted Coates' urgency about Russian interference in the 2016 election, as the president made clear last year during a press conference in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin.
My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
But installing Ratcliffe as Coates' replacement, putting in a Trump loyalist as the head of national intelligence, someone with no experience in the subject matter, has left many senators uneasy, including several Republicans. As of now, there is no guarantee Ratcliffe will be confirmed by the Senate. But there is a guarantee that the topic leads to this week's trivia question. The position of Director of National Intelligence is the successor to the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Dan Coats and John Ratcliffe are hardly the first partisan politicians to be nominated to head up DNI or the CIA. But who was the first, who was the first partisan politician elected to partisan public office to head up either the DNI or the CIA. Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Like a rolling stone, like the FBI and the CIA and the BBC. BB King and Doris Day.
Democratic presidential candidates returned to the debate stage on Tuesday and Wednesday for their second time, with two different plot lines each evening. On Tuesday, it was mostly about the ideological direction of the party, with the leading progressives, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, being challenged by some of the more moderates in the race, led by former Congressman John Delaney, and joined in by ex-Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, Ohio House Member Tim Ryan, and Steve Bullock, the two-term governor of Montana, who was making his debate debut. On Wednesday, it became more personal, as Joe Biden, the polling frontrunner, who was picked apart in the first debate by Kamala Harris over his views about busing and race, continued to be the leading target. But he returned fire for much of the evening as well, leading to concerns in the party that some Democrats may have forgotten who the real target is. Janet Hook is national political reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Janet, it's great having you back on the Political Junkie with your debate analysis.
Great to be back, Ken. Always good to talk to you.
Well, thank you. And it's always great to have you on, especially on an important day like this. And I think it's fair to say, and this is how I want to open up our conversation, but I think it's fair to say that Tuesday and Wednesday were two completely separate storylines, with the focus on Tuesday more about the direction of the party and Wednesday being more about individual attacks.
I think you're exactly right, and the contrast was really quite stark. I think the Tuesday debate kind of benefited from the clarity of the difference of opinion among the various candidates. I mean, there are no candidates that have a clearer kind of ideological profile than Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And that kind of, and they're also very articulate spokesmen for their point of view. So they have a clear point of view and the ability to make clear arguments. And the lesser-known candidates that they were up against almost had the freedom to kind of be as blunt as possible in their criticism of the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing on Medicare for All, the Green New Deal. Whereas when you came to the second night's debate, where you had kind of more high-profile candidates like Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, they kind of came loaded for bear. They were all kind of ready to fight each other in a way that I just think part of it was they had a whole different set of expectations going in than the candidates in the first debate.
Well, I agree with you. Loaded for bear or loaded for Biden. I mean, I don't know which it was, but having said that, I would have thought that on Tuesday, the first night of the two-night debates, Warren and Sanders would have been the obvious targets, and they were in some way, especially by candidates who were polling maybe 1%, 2% in the polls and may be in danger of not making it to the third round of the debate next month. But I kind of thought that the personal animosity that we certainly saw on Wednesday was not there on Tuesday.
That's right. So in the Tuesday debate, the candidates who were attacking Bernie and Elizabeth Warren for their ideas were candidates who really were looking for a way to make a splash. And I think that there was less incentive to go after Warren and Bernie Sanders personally, just because their ideas were provocative enough. And I think it set up actually what I thought was a very interesting and, for debates, surprisingly substantive evening, where the candidates who were attacking Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders for their ideas were very focused and articulate about the concerns that they had about it, about Medicare for All, for example, There were a range of options in the healthcare zone that really were pretty well laid out and explained there. And the flip side of it is that nobody can answer more questions about Medicare for All than Bernie Sanders. And so I think both sides of the debate on healthcare got very well played out in the first night.
Everything you just said, let me play some of that out in some sound bites. Let me start with John Delaney's argument.
With bad policies like Medicare for All, free everything, and impossible promises that'll turn off independent voters and get Trump reelected.
And then Elizabeth Warren was talking about, with all the criticism coming on her about how that these policies won't work, and certainly among voters in the fall, you know, fall of 2020, Elizabeth Warren was saying that moderates were parroting GOP talking points.
We are the Democrats. We are not about trying to take away health care from anyone. That's what the Republicans are trying to do. And we should stop using Republican talking points in order to talk with each other about how to best provide that health care.
I think that what she was getting at, I mean, there is a line of questioning about Medicare for All that plays to its weakness, that you are more likely to hear from Republicans than, which is that the idea that you promise all of these benefits, but in order to get to them, you have to raise taxes, including raising taxes on middle-income people. And what defenders of Medicare for All, including Warren and Sanders, say is it's too narrow a point of analysis to say what happens to your taxes when the overall effect of the program of Medicare for All is to lower costs overall, so that your premiums and copayments and all the out-of-pocket expenses for healthcare go down. So if your taxes go up, it's focusing on one small part of the equation. And this was a line of argument that a lot of the Democratic candidates, the rivals, were raising: is it's going to raise taxes, it's going to cost more, it's going to raise taxes. And they were trying to keep the focus on the global point of Medicare for All reduces costs, or is projected to reduce costs in a broader scheme than just looking at taxes going up or down.
And that was similar to what Bernie Sanders was saying when he was challenged here by Congressman Ryan.
Medicare for All is comprehensive. It covers all health care needs for senior citizens. It will finally include dental care, hearing aids, and eyeglasses.
You don't know that,
second
Bernie.
Of all,
we'll come to you in a second,
I do know, and I wrote the damn bill.
I mean, you know, it was interesting. I thought, of course, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were not on the same stage in the June debate. I didn't think that either one was especially noticeable or memorable back in June, but I thought Elizabeth Warren was especially good on Tuesday because, I mean, she's not a laugh riot, and she's not a folksy kind of person, or at least during the debates she's not. As a matter of fact, when somebody laughed in the audience about something, she lectured them saying, this is not funny. But she knows her stuff, and she can make the argument for her case probably better than anyone.
Right. I thought one interesting thing about this debate is going in, kind of, there was this question, well, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, they're kind of, they hold a lot of the same views, they're courting a lot of the same voters. Will they use this first time that they're appearing together on stage to kind of try to draw a distinction, like, why vote for me rather than her, or why vote for me rather than him? And they really did not do that. They kind of almost formed a tag team in defending their shared views. It's, you know, something that they'll have to do later in the campaign somehow, say, why vote for me rather than him if you hold these views. But it was kind of them against the rest of the pack. And I think both of them kind of shone in a way that even more than they did in the first round of debates. Bernie, you may recall, in the first round of debates was on the same stage with Kamala Harris and Joe Biden when they got into their dust-up over school busing. And he kind of faded from view. And even when he spoke, he wasn't nearly as feisty and kind of out there as he was Tuesday night. Tuesday night, kind of the old Bernie was back, the feisty Bernie. And if Bernie had had another debate like his first one, I think that might have done real damage to his campaign. But so he came back, he was more feisty. And Elizabeth Warren really does kind of come alive when it comes to substantive policy debates, and with her agenda under attack by these moderate Democrats, she really kind of stepped up and showed her ability to kind of to respond to questions that you may or may not have been expecting. She's been doing so many town halls, like every question that could possibly be asked of her kind of has been a million times. And it showed she's very sure-footed. And so I thought it was a good night for both of them.
No, I agree completely. And I think, and I especially agree with the fact that they were kind of tag-teaming against the so-called moderates. It seemed like, in many ways, the night was about the fight for the future and maybe even the soul of the Democratic Party.
Oh, absolutely. Because they were debating not just policy, but the political strategy of, like, if we go big the way Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren want to, will it be the strategy that will kind of bring the Democratic base out, reach out to more people, mobilize within the numbers that you need to defeat Donald Trump? Or are those big ideas scary to voters, you know, drive swing voters to stay home or vote for the other side? I mean, it was a strategic debate as much as it was a policy debate. What does it take to beat Donald Trump? Go big or go cautious?
And I think that answer really, there really was no answer, at least as of Tuesday night, that was left unanswered, whether the party's moving too far to the left or does it still need to attract moderates and swing voters in November? I think we'll have to wait for another debate or subsequent debates to get an answer to that. But let me go on to the final question about Tuesday. What was your report card for that day? Who stood out for you the most?
Well, like I said, I think it was a very good night for both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. They got a chance to kind of lay out the rationale for their candidacies with a kind of clarity that debates don't often give you, because there's a lot of back and forth and lots of different questions. Not that I haven't heard both of them make those cases on the campaign trail a million times, but it was, you know, a nationally televised thing that more people would be watching. You know, I don't know. I thought it was a bad night for Beto O'Rourke. He, you know, really needed to turn in a good performance, and he just didn't figure very prominently in the debate.
Which would be two bad performances in a row.
Right, right. That's what I'm saying. Is the first debate he didn't do so well, and there was a lot of, and he turned in a really mediocre fundraising report since that last debate. So there was a lot of pressure on him to kind of, like, come back, and I don't think he did. Pete Buttigieg had done exceedingly well in fundraising, and he had some good moments. He was not the star of the show, but when he spoke, he had some impact. He had one really important point when people were talking about whether, you know, the Republicans are really, you know, brand us as socialists if we go for this Medicare for All thing. He said, well, you know, if we do big, bold things, they'll call us socialists. But you know what? Even if we do conservative things, they'll call us socialists. So that was his way of kind of mediating between the two wings of the party in that respect.
And at the end, he took on some Republicans whose legacy may be the fact that they stood up for a very unpopular and perhaps corrupt president. And I thought that was a good line, too. He did have his line. You know who didn't have a line? Well, two things. One, a lot of people were waiting for Steve Bullock, you know, because he was new, the current governor of Montana. Is his first debate. A lot of people were saying, well, this guy's a Westerner, and he won in a state that Trump won in, and maybe he's going to shake up the race. I didn't see any shaking up from Steve Bullock, nor did I see anything from Amy Klobuchar, who, as always, seems very earnest and very sincere and makes the case that, you know, she's never lost an election and she can win in red areas of Minnesota. Believe it or not, there are red areas of Minnesota. But I don't think she stood out either, even though she made some very, very good arguments, I thought.
Yeah, I thought so, too. I mean, to the extent that the debate shaped up as a grand debate between the most progressive wing of the party and the more moderate elements, she might have been a much more forceful voice than she ended up being. She kind of made some good points, but she was not really on point in trying to present the alternative to the progressives. That fell more to John Delaney, the former congressman, who's really an asterisk in the polls. He was very articulate, very out there. The moderators went to him repeatedly. But in that, I don't know whether Klobuchar was looking for that kind of an opportunity, but she certainly didn't take it.
One thing I found interesting about Tuesday is that the word socialism came up more than the word impeachment, which I don't think even came up at all. But that was not the case on Wednesday. I mean, the candidates seemed to go after Trump, President Trump, even more so than the conversation we heard on Tuesday.
Yeah, I think part of it was Trump came up more often, in part because occasionally you'd hear a candidate step and say, hey, wait, let's like remember who the real enemy is here. Let's not go after each other so much. The real enemy is Trump. So that was partly a byproduct of the fact that there was so much more negative back and forth. Also, the moderators expressly asked each of the candidates on the second night to talk about impeachment, and it was so long ago, I can't remember whether they did on the first night or not.
I don't think the word came up. But you know what? First of all, going into Wednesday, you knew going into the debate that Joe Biden was going to be a target, that's going to be, you know, a target on his back, and he was.
Right. You knew he was going to have a target on his back. You knew that he telegraphed that he wasn't going to take it all sitting down. He said in advance, I'm not going to go so easy on people. And, you know, Kamala Harris got such a big pop, you know, a burst of attention and publicity and fundraising after the first debate when she went after Joe Biden on his record on school busing and
segregationist. Yeah,
there was almost like an incentive for her to kind of come up with another way to repeat it. So you kind of expected that she was going to go after Biden. And Cory Booker has been kind of underperforming, and he's taken a couple swipes at Biden off the debate stage. So you kind of expected he was going to go after Biden, and Biden had been pushing back on Cory Booker's criticism of his criminal justice record. So you thought among the three of them, Booker, Biden, and Harris, that there were going to be some fireworks, and they all came through.
Look, I know that it's the goal of, you know, the goal of pundits and moderators and analysts are always to talk about the conflict in a debate. But at the same time, you want to talk about the dynamic and what we saw. And what I saw was, again, not only Joe Biden with the target on his back, as I said, but also Kamala Harris, whose stature grew after the June debate, had also become a target. So the first piece of tape I'm going to play is a bit of the back and forth between Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
If you notice, there's no talk about the fact that the plan in 10 years will cost $3 trillion. You will lose your employer-based insurance. And in fact, you know, this is the single most important issue facing the public.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Vice President Biden, you're just simply inaccurate in what you're describing. The reality is that our plan will bring health care to all Americans under a Medicare for all system. Our plan will allow people to start signing up on the first day. Babies will be born into our plan.
The plan, no matter how you cut it, costs $3 trillion when it is in fact employed. Number one, 10 years from now, after two terms of the senator being president, after her time. Secondly, it will require middle class taxes to go up, not down. Thirdly, it will eliminate employer-based insurance. And fourthly, what happens in the meantime?
And then Biden was also taken to task a little later in the debate about his relationship with President Obama, former President Obama, because Biden, you know, will mention Obama's name and record more than anyone at any reason. I was with Barack Obama when he did this and that. But then when Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, asked for a response from Biden about Obama's record and reputation as being the deporter in chief with regards to undocumented people, Biden had refused to answer. He said, well, it was private. My consultations with the president were private. And de Blasio asked the question several times. And when Biden refused to give a straight answer, that elicited this response from Cory Booker.
A couple things. First of all, Mr. Vice President, you can't have it both ways. You invoke President Obama more than anybody in this campaign. You can't do it when it's convenient right. And then dodge it when it's not.
Sometimes you think that Biden is running to be like the third term of Barack Obama. He mentions him so much. And it's not a bad strategy given that Obama is still one of the most popular figures in the Democratic Party. But it is also true that not all of Obama's record is as popular as he is. Even when he was president, there was a lot of pushback about the deportations. You know, the pursuit of free trade agreements wasn't always popular with the Democratic base. So while Obama himself is personally very popular among Democrats, his record wasn't without controversy within the party. And so what Biden has been doing has been kind of opportunistically embracing Obama when just for, you know, the glow of being his successor while keeping his distance from things, so that when the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement came up, He said, well, he would renegotiate it. Obama had negotiated it, and then it didn't get ratified, and it's been relatively unpopular among Democratic progressives. So Biden says, well, on that one, I would renegotiate. Or on deportations, well, I wouldn't deport that many people. So, I mean, Cory Booker's pointing out a true fact is that he's embracing Obama for the most part, but keeping his distance from some of the elements.
Yes, we knew that Biden would be attacked from perhaps every side possible. What I didn't expect that Biden would be so aggressive in kind, because in doing so, it almost like lowered him to the playground fight that erupted. And here's a piece of tape when Biden went after Booker for his earlier stewardship as mayor of Newark.
In 2007, you became mayor. You had a police department that was, you went out and you hired Rudy Giuliani's guy. You engaged in stop and frisk. You had 75% of those stops reviewed as illegal.
I think part of what he was trying to do was everybody's expecting that whoever the Democratic nominee is going to come under attack from Donald Trump. And so they kind of have to show that they can take a punch and they can counterpunch. And I think that's kind of part of what Biden was trying to accomplish is, you know, whether it was effective or not, I don't know. But the idea that you would just take criticism quietly is probably not a very encouraging profile to present for voters who are just, first of all, worried about how is this candidate as our nominee going to stand up against Donald Trump?
Well, that's what I was thinking also. You know, I was mentioning earlier that Kamala Harris also became, because she's elevated herself after the first debate, now became the subject of attacks. Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, went after her on the issue of criminal justice. And I thought that Harris almost didn't seem to have a solid, confident response. And here is Gabbard's attack.
Now, Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president, but I'm deeply concerned about this record. There are too many examples to cite, but she put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana. She blocked evidence that would have freed an innocent man from death row until the courts forced her to do so. She kept people in prison beyond their sentences to use them as cheap labor for the state of California. And she fought to keep cash bail system in place that impacts poor people in the worst kind of way.
That was pretty intense stuff. And I just see watching Harris's response, she didn't seem as steady as she did certainly a month ago.
Right. Well, and, you know, this critique of her record as attorney general shouldn't come as a surprise. I mean, those are issues that have been thorny for her among progressives all along. In a post-debate interview, she kind of said, look, you know, I'm a top-tier candidate. Tulsi Gabbard is not. She kind of dismissed it on that level. I also thought that she didn't seem as well-equipped to defend questions even about something as obvious as her new health care plan. She didn't seem as confident and comfortable in describing and defending the details of that as you would have expected, since that's something that she just put out a couple of days ago. I think what we've seen with Kamala Harris is that she is much better in kind of scripted, orchestrated moments, like the attack on Biden in the first debate was totally prepared, and a little bit less sure on her feet in debate settings or when she's not so scripted.
Let me throw out two names that very few people have been talking about. One is Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado. He also seemed to sound like many of those so-called moderates from the first night by going after, you know, Warren and Sanders and Harris is saying their plans were too expensive. But I thought he came prepared with a certain amount of earnestness that I thought played well, even though he got very little airtime. And also Kirsten Gillibrand, for the longest time, everybody was talking, well, she may not even make the cut for September. And aside from some specious arguments she was making against Biden, I thought she was pretty effective as well.
I'm not so sure. In Gillibrand's case, if she does get any kind of bump from her performance, I'd say it's probably too little too late. And Michael Bennett is one of several candidates, kind of bottom-tier candidates, who you feel like they're kind of trying to hold on long enough to be the backup moderate white guy if Biden falters. You know, he does have a distinctive and to a lot of voters, appealing profile. I just think he's having a very hard time breaking through, and it will continue to be a hard time breaking through so long as Biden is in the race.
Yeah, I think that's true about a lot of the candidates, the Jay Inslees, the Hickenloopers, and Yang and Williamson. I mean, they may have their moments, but it's hard to make the case that they could break into the top five or six. I agree. I think the last question I want to ask you is, do you think, are the Democrats hurting themselves with these kind of nonstop attacks on each other, or is this what debates are supposed to be all about?
I would say yes to both. I mean, this is what a primary is about, is candidates trying to distinguish themselves from each other. I mean, if they instead focus nonstop on Donald Trump, there would be no difference among the candidates. They all dislike Donald Trump. They all want to defeat him. I think voters and candidates alike are better served when the effort to draw distinctions is focused more on policy and just their native smarts in the way that it was in the first night's debate. And it feels less productive both for the party and for the candidates to do it in a kind of a personal, nasty way, which is more of what we saw in the second night.
Well, we had two nights, we had 5 hours, we had 20 candidates, and we're going to do it again with perhaps fewer candidates, September 12th and 13th, which is the next scheduled debate. Janet Hook is the national political correspondent for the LA Times. Janet, you are the best, and that's not debatable. Thanks for going easy on me, kid.
Thanks, buddy.
When Haley Barbour finished his 8 years as governor of Mississippi in 2011, he, in effect, handed the job off to his lieutenant governor and fellow Republican, Phil Bryant. Bryant is now at the end of his tenure, having been reelected in 2015 and term-limited this year. And he, too, was hoping for an orderly transfer of power to his lieutenant governor, Tate Reeves. But there's nothing orderly about Tuesday's GOP primary. Reeves, the choice of the party establishment, who has a massive lead in money and endorsements, is having his hands full with Bill Waller Jr., a former Chief Justice of the Mississippi Supreme Court and the son of a former Democratic governor. The winner of the Republican primary will go on to face Jim Hood, the state attorney general since 2003, in November. Mississippi is one of only three states holding gubernatorial contests this year, along with Louisiana and Kentucky. Luke Ramseth is an investigative and enterprise reporter at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson. Luke, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it wasn't that long ago when the thought of a Republican winning the governorship of Mississippi was unheard of. And now the GOP is trying for 5 victories in a row. This is clearly not your father's Mississippi.
No, it's not. Yeah, the political landscape has certainly changed here quite dramatically over the last couple of decades, and as you say, the Republican is certainly the favorite heading into November's general election, and likely, as you mentioned too, it's probably the current lieutenant governor, who's the favorite.
Well, I think it's fair to say that Phil Bryant does not nearly have the national recognition of his predecessor, Haley Barbour. But how would you size up his record, Phil Bryant's record, after 8 years?
You know, he's got kind of a mixed record, I think many would say. You know, he can point to some economic progress, record low unemployment rate for Mississippi dropping to 4.6 earlier this year, some strong kind of revenue growth after some really, really tough times a few years ago. And he also likes to point to some gains in education, you know, some improving national assessment scores, third grade reading gains, that kind of thing. But the flip side is, you know, of course, is that the Mississippi's economy is still more sluggish than a lot of other states, surrounding states in the South even. And the unemployment rate is still higher than the national average, and the education system here is still, facing kind of a tough time as well. With the latest issue being finding some good teachers because of some really kind of poor teacher pay in the state. You know, other things to keep in mind with Bryant is he does remain really well liked here. You know, he's kind of an everyman governor, average Mississippian type of guy, and so he's still pretty popular here.
Well, just as Barber begat Bryant, Bryant was supposed to begat Reeves. What's going on with that primary, Bryant and Reeves? What's going on with that? And actually, there's a third candidate there as well, right?
There is, yeah. So three-way Republican primary here. As you say, Reeves is lieutenant governor. Before that, he was state treasurer. Certainly has by far the most money in this race and is also a very well-known name to most Mississippians because he's just been in office for so long. So many people kind of see him as the favorite here. But Bill Waller Jr., this former Supreme Court Chief Justice, was kind of late in entering the race, but really immediately garnered some attention just because he does have this experience, because his father was governor back in the 1970s. And he's kind of taken a little bit more of a traditional kind of Republican approach, perhaps, where Reeves has gone more trying to kind of align himself with Donald Trump and talking a lot about kind of the radical Democrats and that kind of thing. And finally, yeah, there's a third candidate, Robert Foster, and he's kind of the younger upstart. He's 36, first-term state representative, kind of sees himself as a conservative outsider. And he's certainly a long shot, but he has picked up some momentum and some media attention these last couple of weeks for some kind of controversial comments that he made. So yeah, it should be an interesting race next week, absolutely, between those three.
Well, I know I read that Waller is calling himself the conservative who can win in November, and Reeves commercials are making the same claim about him.
Mississippi has a brand new license plate, but the out-of-state liberals hate it. It's because of these four words, "In God We Trust." The liberals from California and Washington are threatening to take Mississippi to court just because of this license plate. I'm Tate Reeves. I know Mississippi's values are Mississippi's strength. Our next governor must defend our values every single day.
The strong conservative in the race for governor is Tate Reeves.
And tell me about Jim Hood. I mean, as long as I can remember, his name has been mentioned for a possible Senate or governor, you know, opening.
Right. If it does end up being Reeves Hood in the general, this is something that, you know, I think a lot of people have anticipated for quite a while. And yeah, Jim Hood's name has been in the mix for a while. He is the only Democrat in statewide office right now as the Attorney General. He's been in that office since 2004. You know, he's well-liked in this state. His kind of likability can rival many Republicans. He's very moderate. For example, he's anti-abortion. He's defended one of the state's kind of more extreme anti-abortion laws passed in the past legislative session in court. And he definitely gets, you know, Mississippi's kind of rural political style as well as anyone, I think. So there is a bit of a sense that he could give a Republican like Reeves kind of a real run for his money in November.
You know, it's funny, as you were talking about him being the only Democrat in statewide office, the interesting thing about being old, or at least being covering politics for such a long time, is that I remember the days when there was no Republican, you know, in statewide office or even in the members of Congress. And now Mississippi is such a Republican state. Maybe it's taken a longer time than, but I just remember back in the day, the thought of a Republican, they've won five in a row, governor's races in a row. That is just yikes, right?
Yeah, I mean, the tides have certainly turned. And now Jim Hood is that lone Democrat kind of hanging on and maybe acting a little bit more like a Republican on certain issues.
Luke Ramseth is a political reporter at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson. Luke, thanks a lot for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Ken. Appreciate it.
They call him Mississippi. She don't flow. Spends a lot on the bayou. She don't come to see.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question. But first, some embarrassing news to report. I was wrong with the trivia answer from last week. The question was, which House member received the most votes in the primaries? I agreed with Phyllis Stark of Alexandria, Virginia, who said the answer was Mo Udall. In 1976, Udall received 1.6 million votes in that year's primaries. But that was incorrect. The right answer was Ron Paul, Republican of Texas, who got 2 million votes in 2012. And nobody sent in his name as the answer. Apologies for that. As for last week's question, which was, who was the last presidential candidate to drop out of the race before the primaries, who later made it onto a presidential ticket? The answer is Joe Biden. Controversies about plagiarism and his college grade transcripts forced him to quit the race on September 24, 1987. Years later, in 2008, he was named Barack Obama's running mate and went on to serve 8 years as vice president. Not sure whatever happened to him ever since. But the randomly selected winner is Katie McDermott of Amherst, Massachusetts. Katie wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. One of the most beloved people in all of San Diego was George Mitrovich, a longtime civic legend who seemed to know everyone in the city and whom everyone adored. Last week, 5 days shy of his 84th birthday, George died of cancer. If you love politics, or if you love baseball, or both, chances are you spoke with or knew someone who knew George Mitrovich. He was someone who dedicated his life to the public good. He also served as president of the Denver Forum and chaired the Boston Red Sox Great Fenway Park Writers Series, as well as chairing the team's annual birthday tribute to Jackie Robinson. And he loved his hometown of San Diego. He was also a press aide to Robert Kennedy during the 1968 presidential campaign and was press secretary for Republican Charles Goodell, Kennedy's successor in the Senate. It was his association with Goodell that got him on the Political Junkie 2 years ago. In memory of George Mitrovich, I'm going to replay that interview in its entirety this week. The attacks by Donald Trump on Senator Jeff Flake, the Arizona Republican who has become a leading critic of the president, has split the party. Trump loyalists call Flake a sellout and want him defeated in next year's primary. Others, like John McCain, call Trump's actions a mistake and hurtful to the GOP. Whatever Trump is doing, it is not unprecedented for a president to go after members of his own party. That's what the Nixon administration did to a Republican senator from New York in 1970. Charles Goodell was a moderate, conservative GOP congressman from upstate New York. When Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in 1968, Governor Nelson Rockefeller appointed Goodell to fill his Senate seat. Not long after, with a new constituency, Goodell shifted to the left, especially on issues such as the war in Vietnam. Here he is at an anti-war rally in Washington in November of 1969.
Tragically, our nation's leadership, while striving for peace, has adopted a course that makes real peace unlikely. It is a policy that believes we can brutalize the North Vietnamese into making concessions at the negotiating table, that we can convert by words alone a corrupt Saigon government into a government representative and responsive to the needs of its people.
Goodell also voted against two of Nixon's Supreme Court nominees, Clement Haynsworth and G. Harold Carswell, votes that clearly displeased the Nixon White House. Rockefeller used his influence to keep any Republican from challenging Goodell in the primary, but that didn't stop James Buckley, brother of National Review's Bill, and a candidate for the Senate on the Conservative Party line 2 years earlier, from running again. And with two liberals, Goodell and Democratic candidate Dick Ottinger, splitting the liberal vote, Buckley had a real chance of winning. For his part, Nixon officially remained neutral. Not so with Vice President Agnew. He savaged Goodell at every opportunity, calling him a radical liberal who didn't deserve to run with party backing. He called him the Christine Jorgensen of the Republican Party, referring to a transgender woman of some notoriety from the 1950s. Among those who had an up-close view of all this was George Mitrovich, who was Senator Goodell's press secretary at the time. Mitrovich is a civic leader in San Diego and joins us now. George, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, when you hear President Trump attack a fellow Republican, as he's done quite often, does it remind you of what you heard coming from the White House back in 1969 and 1970?
It does indeed. And there was, of course, Nixon, and he unleashed his vice president, Spiro Agnew, to attack the senator on a continuing basis. And in point of fact, Agnew went to a town in New Jersey, Middlesex, to deliver that speech where he referred to the senator as the Christine Jorgensen of Republican politics. It was mean-spirited, and in the end, the opposition of the White House was, I believe, key to the fact that the senator eventually lost the election. When you look at the returns, the results of the election, Mr. Ottinger and the senator between them got almost 64% of the vote, but Buckley was able to win.
Well, yes, but I'm wondering, I mean, there are a lot of people at the time who thought that Ottinger had a real chance of winning, and part of the reason that the White House attacked Goodell so much is that it would draw liberals away from Ottinger towards Goodell and giving Buckley a better chance to win. What do you think of that theory?
Well, I'm not saying it's wrong, but that's not the memory that I have. And when he came to the Senate, named by Governor Rockefeller, a change began to take place. I didn't become his press secretary until about 6 months after he had come to the Senate. And it was not an easy decision for me to make because I'd worked for Bobby Kennedy. And I sought out particularly Ethel Kennedy's view, should I do this? Well, I did it. And it was one of the best decisions that I've made in my life. And the senator was very conscious of the fact that he held Bobby Kennedy's seat. And so when you try to understand the transformation or the change that took place, in my view, that was a very significant factor. But Charlie Goodell was his own man. And those of us who were on the staff cared about him deeply. He was such a decent person. And what the White House did was just terrible. There were some really great Republicans in the Senate then, an extraordinary group. And Senator Percy and John Sherman Cooper of Kentucky and others came to Senator Goodell's defense and openly campaigned for him in coming to his defense, very similar to John McCain's defense of Senator Flake. I actually was with John Sherman Cooper when he came to New York City to campaign on behalf of Senator Goodell. I mean, look, it's wonderful that you actually remember all of this. The fact is that most people, even of a certain generation, have forgotten. But this was a tumultuous time in our history, and the Vietnam War protests were dividing our country. And Senator Goodell and Senator McGovern and Senator Hatfield and Senator Harold Hughes and Frank Church, and more senators came to see the war as a great evil, which it was.
Well, let me say two things about Senator Goodell, and I think I know the answer to the first question, but let me ask you this anyway. I mean, New York, of course, was and is a pretty liberal state, and so was his move to the left a strategy simply to win re-election, or did he undergo real changes inside of him?
No, he underwent a profound changes. I will tell you, it was the single most poignant moment in the time that I was privileged to work for him. It was a day of the Kent State shooting when students were killed by gunfire from National Guardsmen. It was just a terrible, terrible day. And the senator was in his office in the new Senate office building, the Hart building. And it was my responsibility to go in and tell him what had taken place. And I walked in, and he looked up. He said, "What is it?" And I said, there's been some killings at Kent State. The National Guard shot and killed students. And he looked at me, and he turned his chair around to look out the window. And he was in tears. And he said, "What is happening to America?" That wasn't done on a calculated moment. That was an authentic, real, human moment when a United States senator got very emotional about terrible things happening in America. I know there are people who think that it was all calculated by Goodell. I knew him very well, loved him greatly. It was not calculated.
How did he react to the attacks from the vice president?
Well, I think at first there was a great element of surprise. This was not something that routinely happened in American politics then. It's become all too routine today. I think it's true to say he did not like the vice president. And as we know, subsequently, the vice president was very corrupt. So the senator's instincts about the vice president were true.
Ultimately, on election night 1970, Senator Goodell finished in third place. Buckley did win narrowly. Here's CBS's Walter Cronkite on election night 1970.
In one of the hottest Senate races, New York State, long known for its liberal politics, sent a conservative to the Senate. With thinly veiled White House help, James Buckley got 39% of the vote to 37% for the liberal Democrat and 24% for the liberal Republican incumbent. Mike Wallace reports.
The man who's number one is James Buckley, brother of columnist William F. He is a lawyer and businessman, wealthy and cultivated. This was the second time he had run for the Senate as the candidate of the Conservative Party of New York. He's a minority victor. His two liberal opponents got more than 60% of the vote between them. President Nixon gave Buckley tacit endorsement. Spiro Agnew's help was more explicit.
I do believe that it served to emphasize the fact that I was the only candidate who was in basic sympathy with the objectives of the administration. And this underscored what I'd been trying to say, so that I think it certainly gave me a push in that manner.
And this was Goodell that evening on his defeat.
I do believe that I have succumbed to tides that are running in this country that are wrong, but we can change those tides.
George, how did he take his defeat?
Well, the day after his loss, or maybe 2 days after, I put together a press conference in the Hart Building, and I suggested to him that he begin the press conference by saying, "You won't have Charlie Goodell to kick around anymore." And that's exactly what he did. You know, it was a devastating thing for the family because his five sons had never known their dad other than in the context of being either a congressman or a United States senator.
George Mitrovich was Charles Goodell's press secretary in 1970, the year he was defeated in his bid to hold on to his Senate seat. George, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks a lot.
That was my interview in 2017 with George Mitrovich, the former campaign press secretary and civic leader. George died on July 24th, 5 days before his 84th birthday. That That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.